This is Ian Willie, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 27th of October, 2012. Ian Willie, Part 2. You were appointed base leader in the second year.
Yeah.
What was your approach to being a base leader?
I was very happy to take on the task. The Bass for me had been virtually a coming of age. The from being in a lifestyle, you know, 9-to-5 work, working in a drawing office, going to work, coming home. I worked in an office with over 100 draftsmen, sitting at a board for your standard 8 hours a day, and I was certainly work-wise in a tremendous rut. The Bass for me personally was a huge opportunity and generated long-term a complete change in direction of career, of lifestyle, of the way I operated. And no, the base commander's job I recognised straight away as a challenge, but actually something that I really wanted, because the running an operation like that has so many parameters to it, and so much to learn, and so much to have just that opportunity to make things happen. And, and there were such a lot of things that a base commander can make happen or not make happen, you know. You can run an Antarctic base in a very conservative manner. You can do most of what you're supposed to be doing and take zero risk, right? You know, hunker down through the winter. But what I'd seen from my first year and from what was going on, that if you don't challenge the environment you're working in and challenge the people who are there, you get very little done. And the whole thrust of the survey is to get scientists out in the field, work at their disciplines, produce the scientific data that justifies the existence. You know, Bass in those days for me had two functionalities, right? Scientific research, right? Discovery in Antarctica. And also the Foreign Office job of showing the flag and ensuring that even though the Antarctic Treaty went through, that your presence there of containing the presence for the country of permanent bases in Antarctica was important for the territorial claims. But without the scientific research, the two were necessary to get finance, to make it continue to work. So to support young scientists and get the programs working is the role of the base leader, especially given that I wasn't a scientist and I didn't have a program of my own to do. What's dangerous is when you get a BC who's a scientist, and we're all human. You've got to be able to share out the assets, the time, everything available to give all the scientists an opportunity to do their job, right? And if I'm a geologist, you know, nature says I'm going to be supporting the geology, right? So I was probably in an ideal situation. And the second year, in the first year, because of the party at Foster Bluff, we actually only had one serious scientist at Adelaide. In the second year, we had a full program going. Right? We even had a full-time doc who was doing a physiological program. So virtually everybody had a scientific role to play. So you've really got to share out, work out the logistics and support the different programs. I found that a real challenge, yeah.
Did you work on a kind of a democratic basis? Did you discuss situations and make a group decision, or did you tend to lead from the front?
Tended to lead from the front. I would discuss we knew what the programmes were, and we'd sit down with individuals and discuss their needs, right?
Mm.
Because any of the scientists could have used 100% of the logistic support available, right? So you've got to listen to them, talk to them, compromise with them, work out ways to do what we need to do, and share the support well. And again, we're very fortunate. The scientists worked well together. There wasn't any great...
arguments?
No fights, no... Mm. Lots of strong discussions, right? Because these guys are relying on it to get a PhD out of, you know, they want to get their work done. But no, it worked very well. And we're fortunate, the air support in the second year. The air support is key to getting a lot of the field work in, because without you get the depots out by aircraft, you can spend all your time and effort putting the depots in using the dogs, and you're just depot-laying. If you look at attempts to the pole, you can spend a whole year depot-laying to make one run. And it was a bit like that with some of the scientific programs. If you haven't got the materials, the logistics in place, you can't do any science at all, right?
Mm.
Or you can't get the fruits of the science out, right? You can't fly your instrumentation back out. You can't fly your rocks back out, whatever. You can't bring your data back to base. So it worked. It was a shoestring type operation, but it worked. And everybody, lots of people learned disciplines that they had no idea about.
How did you hear about your brother Lawrence's dilemma?
Yeah.
At Cape Jeremy.
Again, on the routine... squad calls between the field parties and base, which in that case was going to Stonington, and then I heard from the radio up on base that we had a party down the Sound in trouble. They'd gone south as part of the programme. There was always travel from Stonington down to Fossil Bluff, down to the Sound every year. There's two methods of getting down. You either go down the easy way or the hard way. If you've got good sea ice, you take a fast run down on the ice. If the ice is not good, you have to make a haul over the plateau. You have to go out the back of Stonington, up onto the plateau, haul gear up onto the top and make a sledge run that way. This year there was reasonable sea ice and they decided to make a run, and a party of four of them had set off, and not bad conditions from Stonehurst to go down. They got well down only a couple of days short of the Sound, and crossed the lead one night, and it turned out it wasn't a lead, that actually crossed onto a piece of floating ice, as opposed to, because you get huge rafts of floating ice in Antarctica, and normally you can pick up whether you're just crossing a lead act, but this was obviously a very big piece of ice that got onto. Anyhow, they got onto it, travelled on it, slept the night on it, to wake up the next day and find out there was water between them and the shore and the fast ice. And as I mentioned before, for ice to have gone out, it had to be an easterly wind or a catabatic wind or something like that. So it was relatively unusual where they were for ice to float out. They were out on the ice for a long time. Temperatures were going up. And I was much more worried sitting back in base than I ever was sitting in the aircraft on the other side. I think I was more worried about going back home and facing the parents.
Would your parents have known about the problem?
Yes.
So Bassett told them?
Yeah. I don't know whether they had to. I think Bass was pretty good. If there was anything serious going on in Antarctica that there was ever a chance of the press getting hold of, they always used to inform the parents. Or the next of kin, the wife, or whoever it was.
So they tell the parents before the papers did, basically. Yeah.
And certainly that's how it was in that case.
There was nothing you could do, was there?
Oh, zero. Absolutely, you know, in fact, on that occasion, there was very little anybody could have done for them. You know, if you're out with two tents, four guys, three teams of dogs on a piece of floating ice, very early in the season, there's no boats down in Antarctica at that time of year. You know, you're right at the beginning of the season. There's no way people can fly aircraft into you or anything like that. Maybe today somebody can do something, but certainly in that era, there was no way anybody was going to get down there. They're on. Look.
How did he hear about the change of his fortunes?
How he'd got out? Well, we knew they're getting very close to the end. They're running short of fuel. They're running short of grub. And there was decisions about letting the dogs go. At that stage, you're in trouble. It was within a day or so of letting everything go. The wind turned round, the ice blew back. There's a party ran down from Stonington with more grub, and they all met up again, and they're out. But those sort of things in exploration happen, you know. Sometimes it works, and sometimes nobody comes back.
I'll talk to Lou about that
this
afternoon. You had a surprise visitor one day.
Interesting. You talk about crazies. There was there's an American pilot called Max Conrad, who, not a young guy, quite an elderly guy, who had done some amazing feats in small aircraft. But he was on one of these, not a stunt, but on one of these challenges, where he was trying to fly pole to pole.
Oh, yeah.
Circumnavigation. And he turned up at Adelaide. We had no idea this guy's coming. Suddenly, you've been months and months with no outside intervention, and he has an aircraft flying around the base. And yeah, I don't even know that he had radio contact with us. He definitely didn't have radio contact. He hadn't the frequencies right or something like that. Because the runway runs virtually east-west along the top of the Piedmont, right? Southeast, northwest maybe. And the guy flew around a few times, right? And obviously decided he'd worked out where the landing strip was. What he'd picked on, the dogs were spanned out going up the hill towards where the airstrip was in two lines. The dogs, by being spanned out, stay in the snow, and there's two lines from the air. And this poor guy took a crack at landing going up the hill. And it's quite steep. Anyhow, he worked out he was wrong. And we had an old abandoned aircraft at the back, right? So eventually, he's still up in the air. So we went up in a muskeg to the aircraft, right, and set up flares. And eventually got him down on the right strip. But this guy's in a mess. He's short of fuel. We had some fuel that would do, and But there's also contradictory messages from headquarters, right? He told them he wanted to go. They said, don't go. He told the Americans he wanted to go to Pole, and they told him, no. And we had all this nightmare of how can he pay for fuel? How can he pay for lodgings and all things like that? Anyhow, the guy ended up with us for at least a month, I think.
Do you recall his name?
Max Conrad. Max Conrad, and he was quite famous. We believed, the guys who were on base, that he was looking now at his longest leg. He was looking to fly from us to the pole. And okay, today they do it, right? But with different aircraft altogether. His aircraft was completely ferry tanks. He was, you know, a pilot, a cockpit, an engine, and the rest was full of fuel. The boys talked to him over the period of there, and eventually he changed his mind. He decided he would go back, that he'd opt out. The weather was extremely bad, and I think he got worn down also by the restrictions, especially by his own people, who didn't want him there, didn't want tourists coming in, didn't want guys doing all sorts of things. If you look at what people do today, there's people skiing to the pole and doing all sorts of things. It must drive them crazy, because a lot of the scientific programs benefit from the winter and benefit from the isolation. Mm. You know? All the physiological programs, if you start bringing people in during the winter, you lose that isolation, you lose that opportunity to do all the measurements. And anyhow, Conrad left us eventually. And
headed north.
He headed north.
Yeah, okay.
He headed north.
One more question here, if you don't mind. Yeah. You were in the Antarctic in the 60s. You've been back three times in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, I've been north and south.
Would you want to be a FID today?
No, definitely not.
Why not?
A lot of what we did was based on not schoolboy, but adolescent belief in the myth, you know. The travel, dog teams, challenging the environment. If I go in the base commander's hut in office in Rothera, which I've been, he's wall-to-wall books of administration information, health and safety, all the rules and regulations of procedures for this, procedures for that, procedures for that. It's a very different, it is a purely administrative type role that these guys have to carry on now. And the science, although it's basically covering the same disciplines, has changed immensely. Most of the scientists don't winter. They go in and out. Maybe wrong, but I'd be very uncomfortable with wintering women. If we look back to the early experiences, it's not as if when the American base and the British base were there, and we had two ladies on the American base. If you read the books, that was a nightmare, you know? And I think it's got to be a nightmare bringing young men and young women together, single young men and putting them into that environment. I think the recruitment and the sorting out of staff has got to be a nightmare compared to what it was before. But no, I don't think there's a place for guys like me there. The other thing that's frightened the hell out of me, the short periods that people spend in Antarctica as scientists must put them at much more risk of something going wrong. you know, you're doing signs, getting round on things like skidoos. You get out in the field very quickly. You get long distances out in the field. Without a lot of experience of travelling in bad weather and understanding of what you're up to, I don't think you can be properly acclimatised to the job. And there's people going in there for a couple of months, right? In and out, relying on other people to keep them safe. And all our scientists were capable of looking after themselves. And no, there's no place for me down there now. But also in life, if you listen to my kids, I was still much more comfortable living in the past than I am in the future. Yeah. The change in the world, I see a lot wrong with it. There's a lot right with it, but a tremendous amount wrong with it. And the way we're doing everything in a hurry. And I think the exploration and the scientific research that goes in Antarctica can go in on for a long time, and I don't know why we're rushing things. It appears to be a function of the world we live in, that everything has to be done urgently. I think when you're dealing with environments like Antarctica, you've got to work with the environment rather than trying to force the issues too much. Mm. If you force the issues too much, I'm very, very concerned about a tourist ship getting in trouble. I think running people of my age down on tourist ships is fraught with difficulties, and somebody's going to come unstuck, and there's going to be a major disaster, both north and south.
There, we must leave it, Ian. Thank you very, very much.
Pleasure. To you. Appreciate your time. Appreciate the way you pull out the answers.